Okay, guys, so what you want to do is to move your chairs from far back over there and come around up to the tables, kind of. Maybe move around these three tables or come closer so we don't have to yell so loud. Those are going hoarse. And what do we want to do? Cardio. So, what do we want to do? We want to finish off the cardiovascular system, right? And then we're going to take a pee break. And then we're going to go over all exams that you have or any questions that you have, right? But the cardiovascular system is on this test. Do we have class tomorrow? What's the answer to that?
Yes.
And we're going to go over some other aspects, endocrine, kind of pull it together with the cardiovascular system and hopefully integrate all this a little bit better, right, for us. But some main things that we want to cover that might help you on standardized exams, too, if you're pre-allied health, but also in here, our other physiology classes. Anybody already have 412G, PGY 412G? Yeah, it was pretty good. Human physiology? No? No? If you're taking it, you know, it's a really good class to sign up for. And think about that one, 412G, PGY. It's human physiology. Some people say it's easier than this course. Some people say it's the same. I don't think too many people say it's harder. But the thing is that they don't have a lab. If you really like physiology after this class, the class to take, and if you really want to kick butt, basically, take PGY 502. 502 is a 5-hour credit course. It covers all the systems in depth, and it's usually taught by 5 or 6 instructors in the physiology department. Sometimes they bring the clinicians in, too, to cover more case examples. But if you're pre-allied health or pre-med, pre-dent, and they see that on your transcript and you make a good grade in that class, you're going to look really well. You know, there's a general scenario or the general comment that people make at the med school and dental school and PA school and PT school, the vanilla-flavored biology major. And what they mean by that is a general student that gets a regular good grades in biology and a regular good score on an MCAT or a D, you know, dental exam. But what makes you different? What makes you different is doing something beyond that, academically or getting involved. And PGY 502 will be one of those little stars, right? Because the people that actually teach those courses in physiology are sometimes on your interviewing panel at the med school. So just something to think about. But you sure don't want to do poor in those courses because it'll be an indication of what you will do in those professional programs later on. Okay, so that's just something to think about. So if you want more in-depth about everything that we do, remember this is just a survey course, but if you could spend 5 hours a week in lecture doing that all the time, then you really get some really in-depth stuff. So we're going to try to cover some of these main things that do pick up on standardized exams or old exams in here, but also people have come back and said, I've had a student that finished his MCAT test, and they just said, that clarified this for me so well, I didn't mess it up. Even people coming back after med physiology and say, I understood it better when you taught it this way than what we're just getting of content to memorize. So hopefully pay attention, and it might help you later on with things. But this kind of shape of this potential appears on standardized MCAT type of test or, you know, pharmacy test, and it's confusing sometimes. Why is this confusing? So what is this potential of, generally? So we're in the cardiovascular system, so you should think about it, right? And you're going to say the heart, right? What tissue in the heart? The ventricular muscle. That's really important because it's different, and the ions, channels are different in the different types of cells that we're going to talk about. Pacemaker cells are contracting cardiac tissue. So this type of figure is common in standardized exams, like we talked about in class, has a wide action potential to the millisecond. Some similarities in general. What are we talking about? Sodium conductance, boom, you know, for the upstroke, right? And then think about this, kind of like the nerve terminal of a motor nerve terminal of your skeletal muscle. What's so unique in the motor nerve terminal? What's different about it? It needs to release vesicles, fuse vesicles, not release, but fuse vesicles, right? How do those vesicles fuse? That's the key element that we're talking about. Calcium. So we have to have voltage-gated calcium channels. Do we know what the action potential shape is at the neuromuscular junction in the mammalian system? No. We made this bet with our class, folks, and into your class, too. Nobody's made the $100 yet, right? That needs a direct measure in a mammalian neuromuscular junction with an intracellular electrode to get the shape of the action potential. It hasn't been done, as far as I know. As soon as you find one publication, come to me, you get your $100 cash, tax-free. Okay. It's by inference. But the general idea is that calcium comes in, so you have a little broader action potential in the nerve terminal, most likely, because you actually see that in vertebrate preparations where you can measure that, particularly your favorite preparation, crayfish. This is similar in that sense. You open up calcium channels, and calcium broadens that action potential, but this is broadened tremendously, 250 milliseconds versus 2 or 3 milliseconds in the nerve terminal. And that calcium is what causes that plateau phase. And then they start to close, and then the potassium channels were open because they would open higher up, right? Different threshold, just like a neuron. And then they allow the membrane potential to come back down as calcium flows out. When you come back down to the voltage, well, what opened those voltage-gated potassium channels? The depolarization. But you're not depolarized anymore, so they close, and now you come back down to rest. Okay, why is this? Why am I making a point about this? Because this gets confused with the pacemaker potentials. And so you have to know which tissue you're talking about in the heart when you're looking at these potentials and how they are influenced. Now, some textbooks do this a little bit differently, but the general idea is fairly well represented here. Remember, this is not completely understood. I mean, people still make their careers by understanding the pacemaker potentials in mammalian hearts. And it's not completely worked out. But the general idea is shown here. What's really interesting is there's no general resting membrane potential in a pacemaking cell, right? So what's unique here is that at this low value, at minus 60, there's something very unusual. Funny, because unusual funny, is that the sodium channels are open. So it's funny, it's not normal, right? Sodium channels being open at this such a hyperpolarized state, if you will, or negative state. I shouldn't say hyperpolarized because we don't, there's no rest. So let's say negative state, you're about minus 60. But if sodium channels, what's going to happen? Sodium's going to go in. It's going to depolarize. So the key question that has appeared on cold standardized exams, like Kaplan type of exams, I don't know if you still have it, but it's like Kaplan, is that this initial upstroke of the pacemaker potential is due to sodium, right? And that's due to the funny channel, the sodium channel. And it's voltage dependent because it opens at a low voltage and a negative voltage. And it tends to close after it depolarizes. That's kind of odd, right? But then that sodium going in depolarizes the membrane. And what do you have in that membrane? Other types of ion channels. Calcium channels, and you have these two main types of calcium channels. One's called a transient, which means short in duration, and another one long-lasting. Well, the transient's going to open, and what's going to happen? Calcium's going to go which way? Into the cell, right? So what's that going to do to the depolarization? Promote depolarization. So you depolarize more because of the transient calcium. But if you have another calcium channel that opens at a different voltage, that's long-lasting, that one's going to open, and that's what gives rise to really the upstroke of the action potential in the pacemaker cell. That's kind of different from what our thinking is, right, in many cases. So these are the long-lasting calcium channels. So that's what the L stands for in there. So the L gives rise to that depolarization that we talked about. There's other types of channels, like the voltage-gated potassium channels, that open at a higher threshold, right? Because if they opened here, if they opened at a low state, what would happen to the potential? Well, not much, because the E potassium is right here, right? So it's not going to really do much. Maybe inhibit it from depolarizing. But if they open when it's way up there, we got a big driving gradient, right? So now it's going to bring the potassium back down. As soon as it brings it back down, what opens? The funny channels. And it all starts all over again. Okay, so try to remember that there's differences depending on the cell that you're recording from, for the shapes of these potentials, and what gives rise to these potentials. And standardized tests used to make differences among these, and people get confused, but hopefully you got it kind of down now with what we've been talking about. Okay, so hopefully that helps. And we've talked about the heart conduction before already with like what we went through. Remember SA node, AV node, bundle of His, Purkinje fibers, and we're going to talk more about the EKG in class tomorrow when we get to that point too. Okay, so we covered that. And now why would we have such a long action potential in the ventricle? What's the ventricle? What do the ventricles do? Contract to do what? Push blood out to the aorta, the pulmonary artery, right? And you want all that blood out, you want a good contraction, so you want a long contraction, right? So we depolarize for a long period of time, get a lot of calcium inside. Let's think about that depolarization. Calcium, where does calcium come from in the cardiac cells? Extracellular too, and those are voltage gated, right? So calcium's going to dump in, what's that calcium going to bind to? Troponin C. And what does that do? Yeah, conformational change, and exposes a active site on actin or myosin? Actin. Then the myosin head's just waiting, right? Boom, bind. And then the myosin head ratchets. What causes the myosin heads to come off? ATP. And then it's going to bind again and keep going. What happens for relaxation? How does it relax? You've got to block the active sites, right? So you got to block those active sites. How do you block the active sites? Take the calcium back up, right? Or pump it across the membrane and get the calcium back down. So IV active sites. Okay, so you want that long contraction to get that blood out, and that's why we're having that long contraction phase. Okay, so this is part of that. And then you get that depolarization, like in the ventricular muscle, right? The red line. But then the contraction phase comes after that, right? Because you have to depolarize the cell before you can get the contraction. So then we get the contraction and delayed response. So the EKG, you already had in the lab, so we know the general points about the EKG. It's such an amazing measurement tool because you can tell so much with the EKG. We'll do more tomorrow on this. But it's just phenomenal in the sense of how much you can understand about the heart with the EKG. But not only the heart, about ionic imbalance in your body. Even traumatic brain injury can show changes in the EKG traits with, like, inverted T waves, for example. It's amazing stuff. Or high peak T waves by high potassium. So you actually have a peaked T waves if you're hyperkalemic with high potassium, which can be life-threatening. So it's really quite interesting. These forms that you covered in class already in the lab, I know they can be a little confusing, but I'll try to help you out. But let's just look at this, for example. What does the PR segment refer to? This PR segment. What does that actually measure? Anybody? The P wave is due to what? Atrial what? Depolarization. QRS?
The time between.
So let's get the whole thing. So the P wave, atrial depolarization, and it's going to go to the SA to the AV, and then down the bundle of His, Purkinje fibers, and then depolarization of the ventricle muscles, right? So that includes quite a bit, actually. It includes the time from the SA to the AV, through the AV, down the bundle of His, to the Purkinje fibers, to depolarization of the muscles. So if that segment gets longer or shorter, something's happened in between. Generally, the PR segment, if it becomes shorter, that's due to sympathetic innervation. Where does the sympathetic innervation, how does it speed up the heart? It can actually go to the AV node and spend up. The AV node does normally what to the electrical signal that travels down? SA, AV, what does it normally do? Does it help speed it up? No, it slows it down. So sympathetic innervation can actually speed up the delay in the AV node. So this includes the AV node, right? This includes the AV node. So that segment's important. People measure that because of reasons of sympathetic innervation or differences in how the AV node might be working, or if it's longer delay, right? That's a delay in that whole interval. QRS, like we said, is the polarization of the ventricles, T wave.
Polarization.
Of ventricle. Where's the repolarization of the atrium? Sometimes textbooks say it's buried in the QRS complex. It's kind of pokey, because why do I say that? If you had a blockage between, like, the on the AV node or the bundle of this, and you had P wave, you know, like 2-1, P wave, QRS, P wave, QRS, right? You would see the repolarization of the atrium anyways, even though the QRS is absent. But people kind of say it's buried in the QRS, but it's really not measured. It's kind of misnomer. But generally, I'm not going to trick you on that one, so I just want you to realize. Why do we not have a Q here? It all depends on which lead you look at. We're going to cover more on this tomorrow. But it depends on which lead you're recording. You might not even see an S wave. It just depends on the recording. Okay. So what do we want to know by this? We do want to know what these segments kind of represent. Now, intervals and segments, I know that's confusing. I try not to get you to memorize things in here so much, but just the general points. But these things are important for standardized exams as well. But how to remember this so you won't forget it, hopefully this will help. The left side of the QRS includes the first letter for the interval, and on the other side of the QRS refers to the waveform on the other side of that interval. So you get the idea? PR includes the P wave to the QRS. On the other side of the QRS, which gets confusing, right, is the S to the T. So you see, on the other side it includes the T, on the left side it includes the P, but on the QRS it includes the QRS whole complex. So left, just left side, middle, the whole thing, on the right side. Now you won't miss that on a standardized exam, because sometimes they have you measure that, they just show you that, and they have you measure that on the exam. This PowerPoint's all up online and everything, so hopefully you'll help. Now, some other waves that maybe we didn't talk about, or it's not in the text, or you haven't talked about in the lab. The U wave. You can record U waves in another wave too, but it could happen. It's normal to see these maybe in infants. In an athlete, for example, you might get some of these other waves. So it's interesting. There's really some interesting aspects we'll talk about. Elevated ST segments and depressed ST segments tomorrow in class that are really informative. They're called STEMIs. In case you work in a healthcare clinic, you might have heard of somebody having a STEMI. It usually refers to a myocardial infarction. It changes the shape of the EKG, but it can detect that very quickly. It's just another indication to look at the heart. I don't want you to have to memorize numbers like this, but I think in this table is too much, but if you just kind of look through there, that might help you if you're having any problems on these intervals and what they represent. All right. Now, sounds are really quite interesting, right? You've all heard jaws, you know, lub-dub, 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 boom-boom-boom-boom-boom, right? What do those sounds refer to? Lub-dub, what does lub refer to? What should we say? We should say the whole thing. Lub-dub. Lub, atrial contract, push blood into the ventricle. What do the ventricles do? They contract, they're the major pressure. They close the atrial ventricular valves. That's lub. Lub, boom. And then what happens? They're building up pressure. They haven't opened any valves yet. They haven't opened the pulmonary artery. They haven't opened the aorta. Remember, these are happening together, right? Not one and then the other. They're happening all together. The ventricles contract. They finally close the atrial AV valves. Tricuspid, bicuspid, right? They close the AV valves of lub. And then they finally open the pulmonary artery and the aorta. Blood goes through. The ventricles relax. Blood comes back, boom, lub, dub. So how do we remember this? Lub, dub, lub, dub. If you think of that, up, down, then you've got it down pat, right? Because you can think about which way the blood's going. So lub, closing the AVs, dub, closing the aorta and the pulmonary artery, right? Okay, but what if you heard lub, dub, swoosh, lub, dub, swoosh, lub, swoosh, or lub, swoosh, dub, lub, swoosh, dub? What would you imagine the problems are? Lub swished up. Well, what's lub? The atrial valve's closing. But if it's a swoosh afterwards, maybe they didn't close. Maybe they're insufficient. maybe the cord attended that hold those valves didn't close, didn't allow it to close, and you're getting backflow into the atrium, right? The swoosh. Or if you got loved up, swoosh, then maybe the pulmonary artery or the aortic valves didn't close well, you're getting swoosh, you're getting that swooshing back into the ventricles. So loved up, swoosh, right? So these are the kind of sounds that you really need to think about. But some sounds that we didn't really hear and you don't generally talk about is sound 3 and sound 4. I wouldn't test you on sound 3 and 4, but you might hear of them. I'd like for you to hear of it, at least in the physiology class. But these sounds are sometimes normal. It depends on infants, they're normal. But in athletes, you might hear them too, in strong athletes. But it's not pathological. It's usually normal. It's sometimes passive filling of the atrium, for example, blood coming into the atrium after the contraction and blood just kind of flowing into the atrium. Okay, so the general ideas, we should know what sound 1 and 2 is. These other sounds, I think in your PowerPoints online, that this might have got pushed off the figure, so maybe scroll it up, but I'm not testing on sound 3 and sound 4 just for your own information. But Kentucky's known for something. Nationally, they actually use this in textbooks all over the world. Kentucky, the three sounds, the third sound. And Tennessee is known too, because these people described it this way, for four sounds, to get the four sounds. So if you hear like Kentucky, you know, and when you're listening to a heart, your significant other, if you don't know what to do when you're crying about your exam grade, you know, you listen to the heart, you can hear if they have these different sounds. Pretty neat to think about. Okay, so you might get these in different conditions. Okay, so why do we put this chart up? Because it helps us understand the timing, right? You can't have ventricular contraction until you have the atrial contraction. The whole idea is to prime the ventricles and then contract them after they're filled up. But look at the shapes of the action potentials. They're all different, right? Depending on where you are, and we talked about the ventricle plateau phase due to calcium, right? And we've already talked about the pacemaker potential and how that works with the funny channel and calcium, transient calcium, long and potassium to bring it back down, and the whole thing starts over again. Okay, EKG, it's just phenomenal. They recorded in all kinds of animals, fish, mammals. Pretty neat. Can tell so much about it. If you look up EKG, I think it's really cool. The first animal they did in Europe was with a dog. I think it was named Boxer or Baxter or something like that. Pretty neat. Do you remember EKG and ECG is the same thing? Cardio in German with Ks. In English, ECG, cardio C in English, right? Okay, so don't mess me up by not knowing that. And we'll talk about more of this in next class. Okay, so what did we get to? Everybody knows systole is contraction phase, right? Hopefully, systolic and diastolic. And that this is not happening. I'm going to open response questions. In the past years, I've heard people say, first the right heart contracts, then the left heart. But that can't happen because blood needs to flow continuously through both systems at the same time. So the output of the right side is equal to the output of the left side. There's no difference in the outputs unless it's you're starting, you know, had an aneurysm in your lungs or something, right? So the output's the same on the two. They're happening the same. But pressures on the right side are lower than the left side. And I'm going to just kind of go through some of these because we've already talked about that already. But it's just up there to help you go through when you're studying to kind of know these. But the main point is right here. The electrical events that occur with this traces. Now, this trace is of the left side, the left ventricle. The right ventricle, you might see in some textbooks, the right ventricle compared to the left. So with the left, the right side, it's a lower pressure system. You don't have as much as a higher pressure to go through the lungs. You need higher pressure on your left side to get it out to the systemic circulation, like what we talked about when we went to the outreach center and we looked at those hearts, right? The left side, the tissue is a lot thicker than the right side. Remember those parts? Okay, so, but you should think about these graphs and really go through them. And I think the best way is to just draw out on a blank piece of paper. So let's look at this first. And I think it's really easy to start with the EKG trace. What's happening with the P wave? Depolarizing the atrium, right? You depolarize the atrium, what's going to happen? Well, the pressure in the atrium is going to pick up then, right? Because you depolarize, you have contraction. So you get an increase in pressure, in the atrium. Well, what's that pressure going to do? It's going to push blood into the ventricle. So now you have here, the ventricular pressure picks up. Boom, it's picking up because the atrium just contracted. It's pushing blood into the atrium. This next part can be a little confusing. So watch out here. This has appeared on standardized exams too. What's happening right here? Well, this is the QRS complex, right? This is when the ventricle is being electrically depolarized and the ventricle is going to contract. But what happened? The AV valve closed. The aorta is not open. But you're squishing on the balloon. What's going to happen to pressure in there? It's going to build up. But has the volume changed? No. So what this is referred to is isovolumetric contraction phase. The key word, and this is standardized exam type of stuff, isovolumetric contraction. It's happening when the pressure's building up, but there's no blood volume change because no valves are open. Right? So you get isovolumetric contraction, and then what's happening to pressure if that's contracting? Well, pressure in the ventricle is building up, and what's happening right here? The blue line is the aorta. So as soon as the blood pressure in the ventricle exceeds the aortic pressure, what can happen? The aortic valve opens. Now it pushes blood in the aorta. Trick question. Are you ever going to have the ventricle at a lower pressure than the aorta with blood going into the aorta? Lower pressure in the ventricle to get blood in a higher pressure system. Does low pressure push fluid into a higher pressure system? No, it's always higher to lower, right? So this has appeared on standardized exams too and can confuse people. So at this phase up here, when you see the blood going into the aorta, the ventricle pressure always has to be higher than the aortic pressure. Otherwise, you're not going to get blood flow into the aorta, right? So this is higher pressure in the ventricle than the aorta to get blood to go into the aorta. And then when the ventricle starts to relax, you see they're about the same here, but when the ventricle relaxes below the aortic pressure, what's going to happen? Blood's going to go backwards. Boom. And close the aortic valve. Right? So that's when the pressure exceeds the aorta in the ventricle. It's going to close that valve. Now, for some reason, this appears on standardized health exams. I don't know why, but some people make a big deal about it. This is called the dicrotic notch. Not in all textbooks talk about it, but since it appears in standardized exams, I want you to know about it. This is the pressure wave that's recorded right at the aortic valve. So if somebody catheterized the femoral artery, put a catheter all the way up in the aorta, and they got really close to the aortic valve, they could detect this pressure wave. So this is the only place it's really going to be recorded, pretty much. And this is the back pressure that pushes back on the aortic valve and closes it, and it's like the rebound, you know, boom, right? And this is the lub. Dub, right? Love, dub. The sounds. Love, dub, right? Love, closing the AV valves, closing the aortic valve, or the pulmonary artery valve. Both these valves contribute to the sounds, right? Atrial on the right side, atrium on the left side, pulmonary artery, aorta, both of those making up for the sounds. And then you get the whole thing recycling again. Okay? So it all makes sense, but watch out about this right here again. What's happening right here? The ventricle is relaxing. No blood's going in the ventricle because the aortic valve's closed. But what else is closed? The AV valve's closed. So what is this? This is isovolumetric, iso, no change, same, isovolumetric relaxation phase right here, right, of the ventricle. It's relaxing. So nothing's changing. The volume's not changing. It doesn't start to fill until what valve opens? The atrium to the ventricle valve opens and allows blood to go into the ventricle, and then it starts to fill again. And then when the atrium contracts, it pushes more blood in. So you get the idea? You do have to think through it. But if you get confused on the exam, draw it out. Don't try to just guess it. It depends. So the question was about high altitude. So there's lots of things with high altitude. One is that sometimes you're stressed, right? There's low oxygen. Now, we didn't get into respiratory yet, but let's just think about this. Does the percent oxygen change with altitude? What's the average air right here? Oxygen level. It's about 50%, 80%, 20%, 10%. About 20, right? So it's about 20%. You go to altitude, does the percent option change? Trick question, we'll get to that in respiratory. The percent doesn't change. The absolute value, if you took a meter square cube, and you took measured sea level, you got 20% option. Go to altitude, open it up, look here, and there, still got 20%. But the oxygen content, the amount of oxygen is lower, and the partial pressure of oxygen is lower. We'll talk about that with hydrostatic pressure. But what happens is that if you're at high altitude, you usually don't get enough oxygen, so you breathe faster, so your heart rate goes up. You see what I mean? So we'll get to that, but it's more complicated than this. This is in your heart itself, right? In the ventricle or in the aorta that we're talking about. So atmospheric pressure is another thing.
But the threshold for the volume in the atrium doesn't change too
much. No, not like that. But it's going to have an effect because of sympathetic responses and things like that. Okay, so we talked about these. Isovolumetric is your things that people have come back and said, I got that question right on my MCAT because I remember this. Okay, so in case you're doing those things. Cardiac output is a standard measure, and you should know this equation. Cardiac output, the measure of how much blood goes out of your heart per time period, per minute. And what does your heart generally pump? About 5 liters a minute, right? 5, cardiac output, you know, generally. So heart rate times stroke volume. So your heart rate's 70 beats per minute, right? So now you can figure out back to your stroke volume, for example. Or if you're given cardiac output in stroke volume, you could figure your heart rate out generally. But if your heart's beating really fast, if it's beating too fast, like ventricular fibrillation, what's going to happen if it beats too fast? There's no time for it to fill, right? So stroke volume goes down to almost nothing. So your cardiac output drops, even though your heart rate's way up. So it's that trade-off, right? So is that trade-off. So generally, though, you should know cardiac output, heart rate times stroke volume. And, you know, like we talked about, it can change with activity or pathological conditions. All right, so control of the heart, we talked about that in class before. A vagal nerve does what? What kind of transmitters release from the vagal nerve, the 10th cranial nerve to the heart? What tissue does it innervate on the heart? Does it innervate the ventricles? Does it innervate the SA node? Does it innervate the AV node? Mostly the SA node, right? The master pacemaker, right? It's going to slow down the heart, right? What's the transmitter? Acetylcholine. What are the receptor subtype? Muscarinic. Is it an inotropic or metabotropic receptor? Remember, inotropic are ion channels, metabotropic are through second messenger cascades. Metabotropic through a second messenger cascade. Okay, and they're cholinergic. Okay, muscarinic. Okay, and they're going to work on the SA node primarily. Now, the sympathetic system is kind of interesting because it's a little bit different. It can speed up the delay through the AV node, so it can go faster. And that can then speed up the heart rate. That's pretty cool. So it's chronotropic, chrono meaning time. The vagal is chronotropic in a way, too, because it can slow it down, right? So it can slow it down. But the sympathetic is chronotropic and speeding it up. But the sympathetic is something else. It's inotropic as well. So inotropic means it increases the contractility of the heart. So it actually increases this contractility so it can beat stronger. So it increases the rate and increases the strength of contraction together. So that's pretty neat to think about. And these kind of diagrams generally show you these various diagrams that speed up or slow down the heart rate. So you can go through this system and kind of, you know, those diagrams just kind of help you to understand this. So intrinsic and then extrinsic control, pretty neat. Let's review for a little bit on the endocrine. Atrial stretch. What magic properties happen if the atrium stretches? What's released to try to inhibit that? What hormone? AMP, right? Atrial natriuretic peptide. And if the atria stretch, that could be damaging, right? You don't want them to stretch too much. But what does that mean? Blood pressure's too high. Volume's too high. So what is atrial natriuretic peptide going to do? Decrease blood pressure by how? I know we didn't get to renal yet, but pee more, right? Get rid of the blood. You know, get more diuresis to occur. so they could drop blood pressure and then have the negative feedback so you don't stretch the atrium so much. The ventricle has some other really interesting properties. Don't get confused with the atrium after ANP with the ventricle. The ventricle has another kind of really neat process. It's called the Frank-Starling process, or principle. So when the ventricles get too much blood and you stretch the ventricles, it has this neat ability to increase contraction, strength of contraction, and get that blood out. It's like an elastic recoil, if you will, almost, right? But it's actually pretty interesting. So a lot of people study this, and it's studied all the way down to almost all mammals have this that people have looked at. Frank Starling law is really quite interesting. Increasing stretch of the ventricles increases output, increases the stroke volume. So you could think about the next time it fills, it doesn't have residual blood in there building up on it. It's going to cause more damage, right? So get the blood out so it can fill up more than the next time. So that's pretty neat to think about as well. So Frank Starling, you should know that. That's appeared from standardized exams. These kind of general diagrams just help you with understanding and putting it together. Remember we talked about the coronary flow a little bit, right? The coronary blood vessel comes off right after the valves that open up in the aorta. There's a little hole right there, and that starts the coronary circulation, right? And so that blood goes around on the heart and perfuses the heart tissue. Remember, you're not getting oxygen on the heart tissue from the blood perfusing through the heart. It's through the coronary circulation. And it's really quite interesting, we can talk about the other class, but when the heart contracts, when it's in systole, guess what? That actually stops the blood flow in the coronary circulation. So if you stay in systole for a long time, contraction, you're not getting blood. It's actually the ischemic type of response of the heart during that systole phase. And when it's in a relaxation phase, that's when you're getting good blood flow in the coronary circulation. Well, it's right after the flaps basically in the aorta. Right after the flaps open, I should have showed you on those charts that we had in the outreach center that day. And that's where the coronary circulation comes off. For the aorta. And even the aorta is so big, the aortic tissue, remember we talked about that? It actually has blood vessels in the aorta because the muscle is so big in the aorta that it can't just get oxygenation from the blood going in the aorta. There's actually capillaries that go into the aortic tissue. And that's important. What if you had atherosclerosis in those, right? Block those up. And then you didn't get good oxygenation into the aortic muscle. And that dies. That tissue dies. And here's a high pressure system going in there. Boom, your aorta explodes, right? Busted aorta. So kind of neat to put it all together. So number one cause of death, right? Cardiovascular disease worldwide, still the number one cause of death. Same in the U.S. Now, we're starting to get into some equations about blood flow. Oh my God, math, oh no, oh gosh, oh. Right, stress, math, anxiety. Is this a big problem? No, because this is the same equation that anybody gets their tattoo for those 10 extra points? I'm joking. The Ohm's law, remember, I equals V over R? This is no different. I equals V over R. Remember, current equals voltage over resistance. The Ohm's law, when we talk about action potential stuff. This is the same. I is flow. V is pressure. R is resistance, right? So it's the same thing. I equals V over R. So the pressure difference is the V, the voltage, and R is the resistance. Okay, so this is the flow of the blood through the circulatory system. Now, what I want to just mention here, and this has appeared on type of exams before, if you see this lower pressure, absolute pressure is 90 to 10, the difference is 80, right? But in a higher pressure system, 180 to 100, the difference is still 80. So is flow any different? No, if the resistance is the same. But you're at a higher pressure system, so you can have more vascular problems at this higher pressure system, too, because you're about to get the same flow. So it's kind of interesting. The main point, too, is to think about flow with resistance here. And what varies with resistance? The size of the blood vessel, right? The same thing that we talked about in the nervous system. Remember the garden hose and the fire hose analogy? It's the same thing. It all comes back to us again. Garden hose, high resistance. Fire hose, low resistance. How does that affect flow? Our resistance of the system, which we didn't talk about before, but we'll go into it right here. So we all know that pressure is really important. Faster regulate. We'll go through some of this tomorrow. Remember when you get out of bed sometimes in the morning? Of course, you think you're late to animal phys class, and you just jump up and you take one or two steps, and what happens? You kind of might, everybody ever black out a little bit, like one time? And you just stop and think, I'll get coffee soon enough and I'll be functional again. But that, what happens when that happens? When you stand up really quick? What's happening? Blood pressure's dropping, right? Your carotid sinuses are saying, oh, I'm not getting that pressure. So they're going to do what? They're going to say, I need to change the firing frequency, and then they're going to stimulate the heart, and your heart rate's going to speed up, and your pressure's going to go back up. So clinically, this is done all the time in the clinics. If somebody's passing out a lot or having blackouts, what do? They have the person sit on the side of the bed, they put a pressure cuff on, they measure heart rate, they have them stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down, stand up, and they do it a couple times to make sure their heart rate can speed up quick enough to know if it has an autonomic problem or not. That's a standard kind of process. So if you have grandparents that are passing out all the time, you can check them yourself, right? And you can see the heart rate should speed up just for a few beats, right when they stand up to help maintain blood pressure. So it's the same idea. A lot of examples that people have used and experimentally with giraffes, for example, because they're big long neck, and when they drink down for water, think of all the blood pressure changes that happen. You don't see them passing out on the safari, So it's pretty neat. So if we think about resistance, this is really important, and this has appeared on standardized exams. This is on your Kaplan test books if you're taking those kind of things. The key elements to remember, you might have to know this equation, but the main parts that we have to know about is that this resistance, which is in the inversely proportional to flow, right, is that resistance, if you increase the viscosity of blood, remember the Lance Armstrong analogy with erythropoietin injection, right? He increases the viscosity of the blood. What's that going to do to resistance? It's going to increase resistance. It's directly proportional, right? So it's directly proportional. If you increase this viscosity, this N value, it increases resistance. The other point to remember is that pi, which is just, the mathematical term, right? Pi. And then R to the fourth, power. But it's inversely related. So the fire hose and the garden hose analogy. If you've got the fire hose, you have low resistance compared to the garden hose. But how much lower resistance is that going to influence? So if it's to the fourth power, you get the idea, that's pretty significant. So the fourth power is really important. And the example is right here. Even though you've doubled this vessel size, two times that of vessel one right here, what has that done to the resistance? It's 1/16, because it's to the fourth power. It's to the inversely the fourth power. So it's reduced it by 1/16, okay? Don't freak out on the fourth power. How do you do a math equation if it's to the fourth power? 2 times 2 times 2, if it was like, 2 times, right? 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, right? Not adding them together, but multiplying each time. Okay, so don't freak out if you get something like that. I haven't made the exam yet. I'll probably wait till Wednesday night, about midnight, when I finally am under stress to try to make this thing. And I'm lazy, so what do I do generally? What did I do with the quiz? But what about those quiz questions? Every one of those quiz questions came out of old exams. I just plucked old exams, just had them up on my desktop, and just took questions straight out of the old exams and just pulled them in. There were no new questions on that whatsoever. Hint, the idea is do study old exams, but I will try to make some new ones for you, just to keep you going. But what are they? They're general points. Don't have to. Okay. But, do look over those. But when you're looking at an old exam, what do you want to do? You want to cover up the answers. You want to read the question and think if you can answer it yourself, right? And everybody's got the old question test bank of, God knows, what is that, 100 and almost 200 pages or so of old tests, right? So, there. All right, so we've talked about this. Infiltration is really quite interesting because we know that this pressure is important for some things like spiders or arachnoids. They then, eject their legs. Ultrafiltration, we're going to talk about this, like with urine formation, sexual reproduction, for example, and even moving some parts in animals, like this kind of thing, this thing with this nose that comes out with pressure. Bivalves can use it to dig in the sand, for example. Some really neat aspects. We all know like jumping spiders can do this with pushing pressure into their legs and make them jump up, for example. Okay, and a little bit about fluids. We've talked about some of these. We'll talk more about it when we get into the renal system, so we hold off on that. But we did talk about myogenic and neurogenic hearts, right? Myogenic are the type of heart we have. It can beat without the nervous system. We have neural control on it to speed it up or slow it down. And we mentioned this before. What if we cut the nerves to the heart at a resting heart rate, like right now, yours is at rest, unless you're thinking of the exam, and you cut the vagal nerve and you cut the sympathetic nerve, would the heart speed up or slow down generally? Stay the same. Generally, you have some vagal suppression, so it'll probably speed up a little bit. So this is what happens. But the point is that you can have your heart beating without the neural input, right? So it's kind of neat. Invertebrates, generally, they can have myogenic hearts too, but in some invertebrates, they have neurogenic hearts. They mean the nerve has to beat. The nerve has to fire every time to make the heart beat. So if the nervous system's not working, the hearts don't beat. But the circulatory system in animals, like we've talked about with insects and crustaceans, they have an open circulatory system. But what does that mean? Not to be confused, and sometimes this has appeared on exams. So this animal, this crab, for example, they've injected a latex into the animal's circulatory system, filled up the whole circulatory system, and then dissolved the cuticle and the muscle with nitric acid, and all that dissolves, and all that's left is the circulatory system. What's the point here? The point is, look at the gills. They're very involved. They have capillary beds. And actually, from the heart, the blood vessel that comes out of the heart that's right here, the first thing it perfuses is the gills. That's pretty neat, that it perfuses the gills, and then it comes back around, and the gills have a somewhat of a closed system. It goes through the gills, and it comes back to the heart in a blood vessel. And then it comes back in the heart, and then that heart can actually push blood out into the legs. But when you get out into the legs, like this is the claw out there, those endings are open, and then it just pushes blood out into the open cavity out in the leg, and that blood comes back in the open cavity. And remember, there's ostia here, these holes in the heart that can take the blood in and then pump it back out. So kind of cool. Different systems. We could just, it's a crayfish. Okay. All right, so we go on with that stuff. All right, so generally then we should know these comparative aspect. This isn't a human physiology. This is comparative physiology. So generally, fishes then, two chambers, an atrium, and a ventricle. What do the atria do? It's no different in a fish than in us. It's to prime the major pump. It's to prime it to so it can really fill it up, so when the ventricle contracts, it really pushes that blood out. Amphibians, frogs, three-chambered. Two atrium, one ventricle. And the point here is that, we didn't talk about respiratory yet. We'll get to that later. But where does respiration take place in many amphibians? Is it through lungs? Through the skin, right? Moist skin. So what do you expect? A lot of circulatory system in the skin. And actually, from the heart, it actually perfuses a lot of the skin first and then comes back into the body and then circulation. So it's kind of interesting the way this works. But usually, the ventricle to respiratory structures first, just like us, right? Respiratory and then out to the systemic circulation. Trick questions, standardized exams as well as in here. What's the place that has veins or arteries? If I told you that veins have the lowest oxygen in your body, what would you say to me? So you're wrong, right? Which vein has probably the highest oxygenation in your body? Veins go to the heart, but both sides of the heart. So which vein goes after the lungs? Which vein's going to the left side of the heart? The pulmonary vein, right? It just finished picking up oxygen, so it's highly oxygenated. So the pulmonary vein has a high oxygenation. So not all veins being low in oxygenation, right? Not the word deoxygenation. That's a misnomer. It's not deoxygenation, it's just lower oxygen. Right? And then, are all arteries highly oxygenated? What about the artery? Arteries leave the heart. What about the artery on the right ventricle leaving the pulmonary heart? Is it highly oxygenated? No. So not all arteries are highly oxygenated, right? It's actually probably the lowest oxygenation in your body is the pulmonary artery, right? For multiple reasons. One, it's finished going through the whole systemic circulation, but also, before coming to the right atrium, what did you have dumping in there? The lymph system, the lymphatic system, and it's not highly oxygenated, so it just dumped in a whole bunch of fluid into the right side that mixes in, as we'll see later, and then that's not very highly oxygenated, so it actually lowers the oxygen even more. So pretty interesting. If we think about frogs, I don't want to go through the nitty-gritty details, but generally two atria in a ventricle. But the frog ventricle is really kind of neat because it has this little septum in there, and it could kind of, the way the heart contracts, can kind of push blood more through the pulmonary side or the systemic side. It's kind of a neat system the way it works. Generally, two atrium, one ventricle, prime the from the lungs, right? The lungs, and then through it, and then can get through the tissue beds, and then back into the circulation. This is a really interesting animal. I don't want you to have to memorize the different flows, but just generally that you've heard of it. And some textbooks make a big deal about this. There are two different types of lungfish. One's called the African lungfish, and one's the Australian lungfish. It's different in the anatomy, so that's kind of interesting too, because different divergent evolutionary processes probably occurred to get these two animals. But there's a lot of mystery behind African lungfish and folklore behind it. And they exist in like Central Africa and Australia. But think about during the rainy season, the ponds are full, so the fish can swim around and use their gills, right? Now it dries up. So what happens now? Now they dry up. What these little fish do is they burrow into the mud and make a mucus coating around them. But there's no water around them. And they're buried under the mud. But now they're using their lungs to breathe. It just needs to stay moist. But now think of the indigenous people there when you say, oh, this is really good fertile ground after this lake had kind of dried up. I'm going to plant some crop. So they dig the ground, and they dig the ground, and all of a sudden these fish start flopping out of them, and they're alive. So a lot of folklore has come out of that, like life created from these fish in the ground. You get the idea because, hey, they're spontaneously generated. So lots of neat things about it with these African lungfish and Australian lungfish. The point here is that they have lungs as well as a gill system. And they can get oxygenation from both. Crocodiles, still three chambers and eight, you know, two atrium, a ventricle, but that ventricle starts to become more thickened and actually almost closing to get to the full four chamber. But a standardized test question is that crocodiles are the first animals in the evolutionary tree where you see a complete four-chambered heart. Two atrium, two ventricle. But crocodiles, there's even differences among them about some differences, but the main thing in the crocodiles is pretty neat. It has a special foramen. And a foramen means a passageway, like a channel. And I don't know if I pronounce it right, this panese, because of the Italian guy that described it. But crocodiles can dive, right? And they can stay underwater a long time. They can hold their breath. But do they need to really perfuse their lungs while they're diving? No. So what they have is this really neat system to bypass their lungs. So they got a right ventricle, they got a left ventricle, just like we do. But what do? They actually can contract, if they're diving, they contract their right ventricle. The blood actually goes through two outputs. There's a pulmonary artery, and then they have what's called a left aorta. They can actually have the left aorta come off, and then the left ventricle is normal. It has an aorta that comes off, but that other aorta off the right ventricle actually has this foramen that goes from this side to the other side so it can bypass the lungs. That's pretty cool. So when it's diving, it can bypass the lungs. We have that too when we're a fetus in development. We'll talk about that, the ductus arteriosus. It's very interesting. We're very similar in that aspect. But the idea is just to bypass the lungs in this diving animal. Don't want you to have to memorize the little subtle details there. So let's look at the fetus. Think about, where does blood come from in the fetus in the mammal? You know, it's coming through this own circulation, right? It's not mixing with the mother. Don't be confused with that. But where's the oxygenation coming from? The mother, right? They're not breathing. They don't have the lungs to breathe oxygenation. So it's coming from the placenta, right? So sometimes you might see these in old questions from Palmer's types of questions about the fetal blood. We'll talk a little bit more. I thought I had a picture. Yeah, here it is. We'll come back to some of these others. So fetal blood, it's oxygenated from the placenta, from the mother. So what's highly oxygenated in the fetus? Coming on the right side, then. Actually, the right side is highly oxygenated, right? So the blood coming in on the right side of the fetus is highly oxygenated in the right atrium. And then it goes to the right ventricle, And now, do we need to perfuse lungs in the fetus? No. It's still developing. The lungs are late in development. The heart's very early in development, right? You've heard of preemies that are born and they have lung problems, right? They didn't make surfactant. Their lungs haven't developed right. They have to go in an incubator because the lungs aren't developed yet. But you don't need to perfuse it yet because it's not getting a lot of oxygen from it. Just enough to maintain nutrients and growth. So what do you need to do? You need to bypass the lungs. How do you bypass the lungs? Pretty cool. It has these holes between the left and the right atrium. And blood can go from the right atrium to the left atrium. Isn't that cool? So just bypass right on over. And then into the left ventricle and out. But what about the pulmonary artery? It comes out of there. Do you need to go perfusing to the lungs? No. So actually, it's like the crocodile. There's actually a passageway between the ductus arteriosus. So it goes from the pulmonary artery over to the aorta and can bypass the lungs. So that's pretty cool that it can do that. You heard of blue babies? Blue babies? It's not that they have royal blood, blue blood babies. No, they look blue, right? They don't have oxygen. What's the general problems? It might be this atrial defect. People are aware of that very quickly. What do? They go in with a catheter on the venous side, and they can go into the right atrium, and then just the flap might be there. You should check it with an echocardiogram and tell what's happening, and maybe the valve hasn't closed. There's a little flap of tissue there, and that hole's open. So all they have to do, if the little flap hasn't sealed, they just push the flap against the tissue, and it seals up, and everything's just fine. Or maybe they can actually position the baby right, and it will close. The other problem is that maybe the ductus arteriosus is staying open, and the blood's going from the pulmonary artery over to the aorta, and they're not getting oxygenation. That's another problem that is an issue. So let's go back to think about this developmental problem. So we talked about that circulation. So I know this is too much to read right here, but I just put it on your PowerPoint so in case you want to look through different things. The point I want to make here is that early on in fetal development, you look much like this. What is this? You have six gill arches. Gill arches, like a fish. No different, really. And so the six gill arches you have in fetal development are there, but they close up. And as an adult right now, you could go into your heart and you could probably see the ligaments, the remaining structures of these. They exist in you. And these are the shadow outlines of these ligaments that are there from early on in embryonic development. What's interesting about these gill arches that come off, like this one would make, the fourth one makes the aorta. All right? So I think it was the fourth one. Yeah. Makes the aorta. And I won't test you on all those things, but I just want you to understand like these abnormalities. So where does your aorta normally come off? Left ventricle. Does it go off your right side or left side? Generally off your left side. But some people have them off the right side. It's an abnormality. They live fine, but they do get the aorta off. It comes off. It's not the right ventricle. It's still the left ventricle. But when it came up, it didn't make off the fourth, off that gill arch. Instead, it worked the other gill arch. And this gill arch just happened to close. So you can have an aorta descending on your right side instead of on your left side. That's pretty cool. But not only that, the sixth gill arch right here, the sixth one, this one, the sixth one, can be the ductus arteriosus. And as your fetus, it's there. It's useful because you don't need to get blood to your lungs. But when you're born, do you want blood to your lungs? Yes, right? So it closes after birth. But it might not close, and that's an issue, right? You get a blue baby. So they can give you drugs to help close that if they know that's it. But also, it can stay patent and not close if the mother has taken some prostaglandin inhibitors. So prostaglandins like PG2, prostaglandin E2 helps to close that ductus arteriosus. But what do prostaglandins usually relate it to? You take them maybe when you have joint pain or inflammation, right? So a pregnant mother might have swelling and pain. So what does she take? Indomethacin to control that pain. And then it's going to mess up the ductus arteriosus from closing. So it can stay patent after the baby's born and have more likely a blue baby. This is why it's important to take care of situations. So there's some really interesting cultural aspects with this ductus arteriosus. So what is it? Peru, right? Where Machu Picchu, right? Okay, Machu Picchu's in Peru. I know that from three lectures now. Is that these people that are born at high altitude, the government actually has a process. So the government takes indigenous people, encourages indigenous people that live at high altitude to go to lower altitude to have babies. Because if the baby's born at high altitude, because it's all related with the oxygen levels, and the oxygen content, not percent, but oxygen content's lower at high altitude, so they don't get that prostaglandin activation with E2, and the ductus arteriosus stays open. And then they have problems later in life. So they actually go down to a lower level and have a higher content of oxygen, and that causes the ductus arteriosus to close. It's pretty neat. But think of the mother that's been has, not for them, but us, that might be on indomethacin during fetal development in parturition, and then you don't have this kind of feedback. So it's kind of interesting to think about these processes. Heart sounds, super cool. We don't have time to go through more of them, but the main ones we talked about already. But if you're bored over the summer, you know, go online, look up some stuff, and you can hear all these different abnormalities and heart sounds. It's so cool. You can fall asleep listening to them, whatever you want to do. But you really learn a lot by just going through these and listening to them. So they're pretty cool. Indomethacin, I put this little slide on there for your kind of information, and in case you ever have kids, to be careful about this, because it is a problem, and people take too much of these medications these days anyways, right? So it can cause the patent ductus arteriosus, so be careful with that kind of stuff. And then you don't respond to medications well afterwards. Heart rate in a fetus, it is phenomenal. Can you imagine beating 185 beats per minute? I mean, good grief, right? Your heart beats what? About 70 beats a minute, right? But think of 185. That's why you can usually tell early on, the heart develops early in fetal development. And when you hear two heartbeats, you know, something happened, you know. Birth control didn't work, whatever. Right? And, well, we didn't talk about that with endocrine. If you're on the pill and you get an infection, maybe UTI or something else, and you take antibiotics, people know about this, right? It can inhibit the birth control pill, and you don't have that negative feedback process, and you can get pregnant, right? So people are on the pill, but then, girls, and then they take a antibiotic, and then that doesn't work very well. It inhibits the reactions with the estrogen and progesterone and the pill, and then they become pregnant. So lots of pregnancies have come about because of this reason of taking antibiotics while you're on the pill. Okay, but anyways, just to want to make sure that you're kind of aware of important aspects. So in the heart rate in the fetus, you can actually detect the fetal development. Before they had really good echocardiograms, they used to use the fetal heart rate to look at fetal development and age. And so you could put it into that equation, and generally it would work out. Because this is, look at the number of people they used in this thing, pretty big sample size, almost 10,000 people, right? So you think about, look at the heart rate going up early in age, and then it levels off and comes off, and so you can pretty much tell that early on development and hearing the heart rate. Okay, so some interesting aspects. I don't want you to memorize these defects, but just to kind of think about embryological development. There's so many things that can go wrong in the heart development. It's really quite interesting. And usually if there's one developmental abnormality, there's usually something else as well. You know, there's just really weird things like, you know, problems with your fingernails being developed or deep palm creases, and then that relates to cardiac problems too. It's not a direct link. It means the development didn't work out right and that there's some issues. And there's some pretty interesting cases that you might have heard about. Remember, there's lots of problems with developing fetuses. This tautology, four different things that fall out is an interesting aspect. There's four different defects there. Stenosis means that it doesn't open up well. And then some other ventricle septal defects, really a big problem too. Look at the rate on these or the percents. The septum doesn't develop right. Some real issues. Some of these things, the aorta doesn't come off right. The septum didn't develop, so blood's mixing back and forth. The pulmonary artery isn't in the right location. Lots of weird things happen in development. Many of these they can fix with surgery, but still there's some pretty high mortality in some of these. And you can imagine if the left heart doesn't develop right, it doesn't get the right development, there's a high mortality with that too. So what do they do heart transplants with in some of the animals for humans? With another animal. Sometimes pigs, but another animal. they try to do them too, but they're decreasing in the numbers, and some people have concerns with the baboons. Baboon heart's about the size of a human heart, and they sometimes use those as an intermediate until they can get a donor heart. The artificial hearts are used too, but you know, in Louisville, they're well recognized for actually developing the artificial valves, right, that they can put in. But the problem was with those mechanical valves, they would destroy the red blood cells. And so they're trying to make softer valves with different types of tissue. Some really neat research going on at U of L on these artificial valves. But they tend to use the valves from pigs because they're very similar in the same size, like what we were talking about, the pulmonary or the aortic valves, because they can sew them in. But some people have issues with all that stuff. Okay. And SIDS is really quite interesting. Some people think it has to do with genetic abnormalities in the ionic channels of the heart as well, some other things. So just think about all the channels inside the heart and regulation of those ion channels, sodium, calcium, pacemaker potential, you know, in contractility, in all those proteins. Anything goes wrong, heart might not work right, right? Or stress the heart out or push it a little bit faster and it can't keep up or, you know, do things. So many things can go wrong with the heart. I think this is really neat. This is just in development, and I won't ask you these detailed questions, but think about the heart development here. All these channels that we've been talking about, funny channel, ranitidine, sodium calcium exchanger, they have different expression levels over development. So you can imagine if this expression isn't developed, you know, right, how the heart's not going to work right, right? And then it changes with age. And it's kind of interesting with disease or too much or too little of expression. You know, this is gene regulation, right? That goes on. It's really quite amazing. Okay. And as we had mentioned before, many, you know, a third to 50% of all pregnancies end up in spontaneous abortions. A lot of these cases are dealt with ion channel pathologies. You can imagine if the heart doesn't develop right, the rest of the fetus isn't going to develop right, and then it's going to have maybe a spontaneous abortion. So it's not that uncommon to have spontaneous abortions occur. If you're ever into the healthcare field and you don't want to spend a lot of money going to medicine and health, but you want to have a major impact in health, these people are so cool. These technicians that do cardio echograms. Anybody ever shadow anybody that does an echocardiogram? They're people that just specialize in pediatric echocardiograms versus humans. What they can do with this echocardiogram, they can actually measure the cardiac output. They can measure the diameter of the ventricle. They can measure if it's the septal defect. They can measure if there's a ductus arteriosus or the atrial connections between the two atria. They can do lots of neat things with non-invasive technology that is phenomenal. But think, this is what they're going to send the cardiologist. If this guy doesn't get it right, or gal, this technician, right, then the information's wrong to the cardiologist to think about what to do. So very important jobs out there if you're interested in other professions that, to think about. So let's just quickly kind of think about the rest of the circulatory system, and we'll quickly wrap this up here. So I was talking about this elastin or elastic recoil in different aspects. But remember, the veins take up blood, right? They can distend. Your veins right now is probably pooling your blood. Most of your blood is going to be mobilized when you start to exercise, when you start to move. Your blood's going to be mobilized, and you exercise, it's going to go to your skeletal muscles. You're going to have vasodilation, and it's going to happen there. Let's talk about some of the other distensibility that goes on. So in past test questions, somebody asked, what is distensibility? Distensibility is like elastic recoil. Let's think of the aorta. The aorta, what's going to happen? Ventricle contracts, pushes blood in the aorta. What happens in the aorta is it's distensible. It has like elasticity to it. It's going to extend. What's that going to do to the pressure, the systolic pressure? If we had a pressure transducer in the aorta, what's going to happen in these two different scenarios? One, the artery can extend out and then have elastic recoil back. What's going to happen here? The blood's going to backflow, close the aortic valve, the blood's going to go down the systemic circulation, right? But let's say now it doesn't have that distensibility. It's a steel pipe. Pump the same amount of blood into the steel pipe. What's going to happen to pressure in there? It's not going to be dampened. It's going to stay there. So pulse pressure is going to go way up, right? So pulse pressure is going to be higher. Systolic pressure is going to be higher. Now, what's going to happen to when the heart relaxes and blood's flowing down, what's going to happen to the one that can have the elastic recoil back down? It can maintain that pressure wave, right? But if it's a steel pipe, it's not moving, pressure shoots up, but then pressure's going to do what? As it goes down the line, what's going to maintain the diastolic pressure? What's going to maintain that diastolic pressure? In the steel pipe, there's nothing there to maintain it, right? So the difference in the pressure wave is going to be high and low in the steel pipe. And a compliant, what's called compliant artery, or aorta, that the stem stability can maintain that pressure wave. You don't peak, and you're not going to drop down to the bottom. So people use that as a measure called pulse pressure difference. And it has appeared on tests before, too. So the pulse pressure difference from diastolic to systolic will be higher with what? An aorta that is hardening, like hardening of the arteries, which is due to what? Plaque buildup, right? So if you have a plaque buildup and you decrease your distensibility, your pulse pressure will be higher. You have a higher systole and probably a lower diastolic pressure. If you have a normal compliant artery, up and down. So think about that with health as well. It's pretty neat to think about. Okay, and then what maintains mean arterial pressure is really that elastic recoil, because it's not allowing diastolic to drop down all the way to the bottom, right? It's not bottoming out. So mean arterial pressure, how do you measure this? And this is a good equation to remember. Okay. Is the mean arterial pressure is diastolic plus one-third systolic minus diastolic pressure. It's usually appeared on standardized exams as well. So they might ask you to give you some values and calculate the mean arterial pressure. And so what does that mean? It's not just the systole minus diastole or the average between those two. It's actually the diastolic pressure plus one-third, the difference between the systolic and diastolic pressure. It gives you the mean average. And what is that maintained with? The elastic recoil, pretty much, of the aorta. All right, so that's just why it's important to put all this together. Okay. So if we look at this figure, this is really quite neat. Think about systemic starts after the heart. So systemic circulation, aorta, and arterioles, capillary bed, venules. So standardized kind of questions, and even in here, where is the major drop in the arterial pressure in the systemic circulation? And what are you going to say? You have choices. Aorta, arterioles, capillary bed, venules. What are we going to say? Not the capillaries, but a lot of people will choose the capillaries because they think that's the smallest ones and that's where the biggest drop is. It's in the arterioles because this is where your smooth muscles are. This is where the high resistance is. And on the other side, it's already dropped, right? So the biggest drop is in the arterial bed. Other types of questions around this, where's the biggest cross-sectional area of the total circulatory system? Now, the biggest vessels, like the aorta, are the inferior superior vena cava, but total cross-sectional area are the capillary beds, right? Because you have so many capillary beds, if you add up the cross-sectional area of all of those, there's quite a bit. Where is the lowest pressure in the system? You have a closed circulatory system. Can you ever get low pressure going to high pressure? No, right? Your physics stuff. So where's the lowest pressure? Before the heart. Where's before the heart in your circulatory system? Vena cava, right before the right atrium. Okay, so lowest pressure over here. Right? So don't get confused. And we've talked about pressure regulation now with smooth muscle around the vessels. You can have some local regulation. We've talked about that before. Remember, if you exercise your skeletal muscles, what's going to happen? You're exercising. What's the byproduct? CO2. What's that going to do to pH? Lower it down. That itself, the low pH causes vasodilation. What else is happening if you're contracting and causing all those biochemical processes going on? Temperature rises, right? That causes local vasodilation. So these local regulatory processes can change the process. What's really interesting in the heart, though, too, if the heart becomes hypoxic, there's actually a release of adenosine, and it causes the coronary arteries to start to vasodilate, so you can increase blood flow. So it's kind of like trying to repair itself, trying to, you know, correct the problem. That's pretty neat. So these are kind of gee-whizzy things. Oh, this is interesting because of what we talked about with sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation, but also sympathetic itself. So if you're going to exercise, so you're scared, you're going to run from that bear. Remember that bear that's chasing you, your sympathetic response? What do you want to do? You want to get blood flow to what? Your skeletal muscle. Do you care about your GI tract? No. So you want to vasoconstrict your GI tract, but you want to dilate your blood vessels to your skeletal muscle. So the sympathetic system, it's the same transmitter, epinephrine, but different receptor subtypes. Remember, it's always a receptor. The beta receptors can cause vasodilation. The alpha receptors cause vasoconstriction. You surely don't want to vasoconstrict your heart, coronary arteries, right? You sure don't want to vasoconstrict your bronchi or your blood vessels to your lungs. So those, or your brain, right? So those don't have the A receptors for vasoconstriction. But your other tissues, like the skeletal muscle, will have beta receptors for dilation, or your heart, for example. So that's pretty neat to think about epinephrine doing different things, or depending on where those receptors are. Okay, so you can kind of go through these figures. These are kind of fun to go through. We're going to go through some of this tomorrow too. But like we talked about intrinsic, you know, local regulation, and then extrinsic, like hormones. Remember we talked about hormones that can have an effect on the circulatory system, increase heart rate, for example, and cardiac output, or vasoconstriction like epinephrine. So angiotensin 2 is a vasoconstrictor, a strong vasoconstrictor also. So those are just there to kind of give you an idea. Capillaries, let's just go through this capillary bed real quick and then we're done pretty much. The capillary bed, you know, red blood cells to the capillary bed. But when we think about capillaries, we have to think about what do we want in the capillaries. We want to be able to get fluid out, ions out, nutrients out, maybe take in waste products a bit, right? But do we want big pores or small pores? Well, it depends on the tissue that you're perfusing, right? So if it's a muscle cell, you don't need RBCs to go out to the red blood cells, right? So you have these continuous capillary beds with kind of tight junctions, not real loose junctions. So you get small ions to go through, amino acids, nutrients like glucose, right? You need to get that to the tissue bed. So you've got to have something to go through. So that's important. And then get rid of waste products like we've talked about over and over again, you know, that kind of stuff. And then we've talked about different kinds of blood flow to different aspects, like contracting for your GI tract. You're going to contract the arterioles, those smooth muscles that go around the arterial bed to your GI tract and maybe dilate into your skeletal muscle. All right, so the main thing is this regulation that we've talked about. We'll get back to the capillary beds here in a little bit. But this is just another figure to emphasize total cross-sectional area is biggest in the capillary beds. You see the top graph up there, blood flow stays the same, like 5 liters a minute throughout all of it. Velocity decreases the most in the capillary beds because of all the surface area, all the cross-sectional area is increased a lot. But it's going to pick back up as it goes back in the venules. But blood pressure, draw the blood pressure graph on this. Right? It's going down, the lowest is over here, right? On the venule side, going before it goes into the heart, in the vena cava. Okay, so we can kind of pass this. This figure is important to understand. It's been on standardized exams. We probably might pull up something like this on the test. And I know there's so much on this test, you just wonder like, oh my gosh, what is going to test? We can't put everything on. So what do? What we don't put on this exam, we just save it to torture you on the final. Sorry. I know. Sadistic. But this is important to understand generally. So the capillary bed from the arterial side to the venous side. Okay? So try to think about this. And we're talking about filtration. So we're talking about fluid going from the capillary bed into the interstitium. Okay? So what drives it on the arterial side? The take-home here is hydrostatic pressure. It's going to be high on the arterial side. It's going to cause filtration and fluid to go into the interstitium. If we lose salts and water and maybe some other small molecules, what happens to the protein content inside the capillary bed? It goes up. Now, some textbooks show it like this, and other textbooks have a little subtle difference. I just want you to kind of think about it. It depends, supposedly, in the primary literature, it depends what tissue bed you're talking about. But think about the concept. If fluid's going out, salts are going out, but you're building up proteins, what happens to the osmotic pressure inside of the blood vessel? It's going to increase, right? So if you have osmotic pressure, what's that going to do to the fluid? It wants to dilute that, right? So as you go through here, this is that tie. This is like what they call aniconic pressure. Think of it like osmotic pressure if you want to, okay? In some textbooks, they'll actually show aniconic pressure, osmotic pressure, to build up as you go from the arterial side to the venous side. Depends on the tissue you're talking about. But what's happening to hydrostatic pressure as you go from the arterial to the venous side? It's dropping. So if that drops below the aniconic pressure, then now you can have absorption. So on the venous side, you have fluid from the interstitium going back into the capillary to take fluid in. It's because hydrostatic pressure drops. Now, depending on the textbook, they might show a little bit of aniconic pressure actually building up a little bit, right? And so that could build up, and then that could cause more fluid to go this direction, right? So think about the trade-off of these two. If you get that on a test question, just work it out. Draw it out. Don't try to just do it cold turkey. Work it out. Draw out the figures. All right? So what happens if that fluid gets out in the interstitium? Where is it going to go? Does it just stay in the interstitium? No. It needs to be taken away. Some of it might be taken back in the venous side of the capillary bed, but others, we want to get it out to the lymphatic system. So the lymphatic system is really important to get the fluid out. So it takes that excess fluid in the interstitium. What else does the lymphatic system do? What's its purpose? The immune system, right? For your white blood cells, right? And so if you have a cut in your arm and you get a bacteria in there, it's going to take that in the lymphatic system. It's going to go hit your lymph nodes, and the lymph nodes are going to say, oh, this is not normal. This is not, your self-recognized cells. And it's going to develop, that antigen's going to develop antibodies, or the white blood cells are going to kick in and say, we got to fight this thing, right? So it's very important, but also it takes away that interstitial fluid. What happens if the interstitial fluid builds up? You get edema in your legs or your hands or something. So there's some real issues with the lymphatic system if you don't get the good flow, but it can just be taken up kind of through these little flaps. And it's interesting because they want the bacteria to be taken in there. They want the foreign substances to be taken in there because then you can detect it. So the lymphatic system is very important to taking the blood flow back. It dumps in right before it enters in back into the right side of the heart. It's going to enter in and dilute that blood out, right? And it's not highly oxygenated, so it decreases oxygen even more in the blood right there. But it's quite important. And if this gets blocked, let's look what happens. You can get what's called elephantitis. And we have put these pictures in. This is due to a parasite. It's common. It can happen in Central Africa and in South America with this parasite from mosquitoes. It can cause like a scrotum to build up or elephantitis, breast to build up, wherever the lymph system can be, and that normally drains fluid, and it's that little booger from mosquitoes. And so mosquitoes are really problematic about this thing. But it shows you how important the lymph system is to maintain function. So let's just go through the capillary beds a little bit and talk about different types of capillary beds real quick. Continuous capillary bed, like in skeletal muscle. All right? Skeletal muscle, you don't want big molecules to go across, just the ions and water. So it's called a continuous capillary bed. In the kidneys, you want filtration, right? So you've got pores. But do you want big red blood cells to go out in your urine? No. So it has pores. It might be called a fenestrated capillary bed. But where do we have these big holes, these big pores that are so big that you could get a red blood cell to go through? Where do red blood cells come from? Bone marrow, long bones, right? Your ribs, long bones. So those big red blood cells, how do they get into your blood? They got to get into your blood circulation. This is how they get in. These big sinusoidal capillaries, big gaps between so the RBCs can get inside your blood circulation. Another point we mentioned about the lymph system, remember that email I sent you about the spleen, right? Very important, right, to make white blood cells. Pretty important. That guy, almost died because they missed what the spleen actually is doing in this person that had the infection. So pretty interesting. So these figures are just there kind of re-reducing what we've already gone over, just kind of for you to think about. Capillary is really quite a number of them, high cross-sectional area, and we've talked about basically mobilizing blood with veins. We talked about that in lecture 2. You could actually see your valves where they are in your vein system by pushing there and actually pushing blood up, and you can see the back flow of these little valves. Okay, so these figures here are basically there for you to look over and kind of think about regulation of cardiac output and what can maintain blood pressure. They're all in those PowerPoints. But I would just kind of go through it. We'll go through some of this tomorrow in class too. But we'll come back to the renal system and put in the renal system with the endocrine in the cardiac system when we get to the renal system also. But think about regulating peripheral pressure and cardiac output. All influences the mean arterial pressure, right? So we talk about hypertension. You could have hypertension that's neurogenic from the brain, defects in the brain. You can have nephrogenic hypertension, nephron the kidneys, right? So people try to find out why they might have hypertension. Is it nephrogenic or is it neurogenic issues? And so to try to regulate that. The last part on this is we've already talked about all this. And so you can kind of go through this ideas, and it's kind of neat to look through it and kind of think about how this is all working. The last part is with exercise. And when you exercise, where does the blood get mobilized from? Veins, right? Contraction of skeletal muscle. Do you really change much blood flow to the brain? Not too much, right? If you look at the output up here, the amount of blood going to the brain, the flow, 650 milliliters per minute, really no different when you're at rest. But what's increasing? The skeletal muscle. What's decreasing? Really the GI tract, right? So you're not getting as much blood flow to the GI tract. But why does it overall increase? Because your heart rate's increased, right? You're getting more blood to go around. The cardiac output's increased. But the heart and the brain, really, the heart goes up a bit, but, the brain really doesn't change too much. You might decrease your trying to regulate temperature balance by increasing blood flow to the skin, but it's going to depend on your temperature and the environment temperature and all that good stuff, right? And bone, do you expect much difference in bone? Not too much difference, right, in blood flow to the bone. Okay, so that's basically that part of going over the cardio. Let's take a pee break. Pee break, come back 5 minutes, go over any questions that you have on old exams. I know you need a little break. Throw some cold water in your face, get some caffeine pills or whatever you need. 5 minutes? 5 minutes? Okay.